Hello and welcome to the 12th Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward, and these podcasts are a chance to hear from experts across the Eastern Arc universities of East Anglia, UEA, Essex and Kent. Today we're going to look at resilience during displacement following natural or human disasters. The United Nations defined resilience as the capacity of a system, community or society potentially exposed to hazards to adapt by resisting or changing in order to reach and maintain an acceptable level of functioning and structure. Adapting, resisting and changing are going to be increasingly important as the current climate crisis changes our world, with an increasing frequency of flash floods, famine and wildfires, and it's imperative that we understand how we can learn from previous disasters and prepare for the future. Joining me today to look at how individuals and communities develop resilience are four colleagues who have worked on issues around disaster mitigation, recovery, displacement and migration. Dr. Gina Janitel Reinhardt is a reader in the Department of Government at the University of Essex. She studies how citizens and policymakers make decisions under uncertainty and how these decisions affect economic, social and political development and subsequent policy outcomes. Professor Roger Few is a professorial research fellow in the School of International Development at the University of East Anglia. His research centres on the connections between environmental change, risks and human well-being, mainly in lower income settings. Dr. Paola Di Giuseppe Antonio De Franco is a research fellow in the School of Philosophy and Art History at the University of Essex. She was one of the original Eastern Arc Fellows in the first phase of the consortium. Her research combines material culture, heritage and cognitive science to explore how new technologies impact heritage-making processes and the interpretation processes of the past. Joining them is Vicky Gukol from the Open University of Mauritius, who works for the Mauritius Emergency Planning Agency. He's been closely involved in assessing processes to mitigate flash flooding and looking at early warning systems on the island. I started by asking each of them to talk a little bit about the area they work in, and particularly issues around resilience and displacement. First of all, Gina.
I study social and community level resilience, which I take to mean the ability to adapt and bounce back from an external shock. By external, I mean that no one has planned the shock. It's not an intentional action. And I usually focus around disasters that occur as a result of a shock. So the shock could be an earthquake or a hurricane. It could be a bridge collapse or a gas explosion, but then there's a disruption to society that comes from that. And I look at how communities and individuals and systems as a whole are able to recover from that shock and come back to their original development trajectory and even improve that. My work covers a variety of things, but a lot of it focuses on trust that people have and the relationship between trust and resilience. So the more people trust each other, the more willing they are to listen to each other and follow directions and suggestions when it comes to managing and recovering from these shocks. And that means that if you can rely on other people to help you, if you can rely on each other to contribute time and resources and to tell the truth, right, to not undercut each other, there's a lot that you can accomplish. And then there's a lot that gives in terms of building your own and your community's resilience.
So Vicky, could you say a bit about your work?
Yeah. In fact, my study is based about flood management. Flood management in Mauritius, the mechanism and strategies, and also about early warning systems. Recently in Mauritius, we were faced with a problem of a flash flood, where 11 people lost their life. And also we were faced by an oil spillage crisis, which has completely affected the country in terms of economy, resources. So my research will be more on what strategies, recommendations that I will come up so as to better manage flooding emergencies. In case of flooding, there's a huge amount of people who need to be displaced from their original residence, and we have to find shelters for them, temporary shelters. And also, it has been noted that during flooding, there's a lot of planning which needs to be done. People, like we see IDPs, internally displaced persons, they are some sort like reluctant to move from that shelter. I take all these factors into consideration so that later on I can recommend the government or Mauritius on practical measures in terms of flooding and also about these people, internal displaced persons.
Roger, could I come to you next?
Right, okay. So I work on various different aspects of disaster risk and recovery. Displacement is, I suppose, an element of that. I think it's important to note at the start of this that I've worked with a lot of different disciplines over the years. I've worked with physical scientists around hazards. I've worked with medical scientists around sort of health implications, with social psychologists, and with people in the arts. And I think a lot of the insights I've drawn have really come from this very creative coming together. And I think it's really important to stress that point first. And that's been fostered in recent years with changes in the way funding. So as I say, I'm not a specialist on displacement, but in the work that I've done around vulnerability and recovery, I mean, there's three particular recent projects I would probably link to, which one of this was a project looking at volcanic risk in Latin America and the Caribbean called the Striva Project, where we looked at various different aspects of risk, one of which was vulnerability to events, but also trying to understand what happened during long duration volcanic episodes. Other projects are of work I'm doing at the moment in India, looking at representations of recovery in the media, in policy, how basically ideas and stories about recovery and priorities get created. And that has a clear link to situations of displacement and resettlement. Work in Ethiopia and Kenya looking at drought risk and how that leads to population movement. Again, not the primary focus, but a key part of it. But the work that I've done that's most focused on displacement has been working in Colombia, actually looking at situations where people are displaced by conflict and then face situations of risk. So it's slightly sort of turning round the debate, as it were. So there's, you know, three key elements for me. One is the short-term displacement that happens during and immediately after a disaster, which could be in relation to evacuation, or it could be short-term migration to another area. For example, this happens with drought situation and then returning. Then there's the long-term, the permanent displacement and the resettlement issues that raises. And then there is this third element, which I think is really key as well, which is recognizing that actually people may be displaced by multiple different threats. And in Colombia, displaced by conflict, then moving to the only available land, which is almost all cases, tends to be physically marginal land because it's prone to hazards.
Paola, could come to you next.
I'm the Istanak Fellow in the Digital Humanities at the University of Essex. I work on heritage and digital heritage especially. I decided to start a new line of research which explores the role that new technologies, with special reference to these digital replicas, might have in rebuilding places that have been destroyed by natural catastrophic events. Now I'm developing a project that explores also the idea of 3D printing and how it might help communities to rebuild a sense of place. But meanwhile, I've also done an ethnography. So I went to three areas specifically. I focused on the earthquake that happened in Irpinia, South Italy in 1980. Then I focused on the earthquake in L'Aquila 2009 and the last earthquake in 2016 that affected a very large area in central Italy. And the reason why I decided to explore different areas was also because the earthquake in Italy is quite recursive. and we can learn from the past. And I also wanted to understand how people might value, you know, new technologies in different stages. So when, you know, the reconstruction has happened already and people have moved back to new towns, when the reconstruction is happening, like in L'Aquila, and then when people are in displacement, like in central Italy now, after the earthquake in 2016. It's for us a way to make people reflect on the process of reconstruction and how, you know, the sense of place is affected by the whole process, like by the earthquake, but also the whole process of reconstruction. And we also want to raise awareness and explain that, you know, when you lose your place of trust and you have to live in displacement for, let's say, about 10 to 20 years, which is the average in Italy when it comes to reconstructions of places, you know, we want to raise awareness on what the effects are on the community and, you know, what the strengths of the communities might be during the displacement time, and also what happens if, you know, the town that has been rebuilt doesn't really respond to the needs or the identity of the community. We've also exploring heritage times, because we've been thinking a lot about the fact that when there is a natural catastrophic event, you know, the way the narrative is built around these events is always to think about this dichotomy between the before and after. You know, there is this time in displacement, which is very long when it comes to Italy and other areas. And so we really want to explore, you know, this idea of what happens during this time of displacement and how, you know, there are heritage times and we can talk about them, especially when focusing on displacement of communities.
Paola, thanks very much for that. A couple of issues there that will be really interesting to explore with all of the participants. That sense of place, I think, is very interesting, and the effect that has in recovering from an event and developing that resilience, that sense of place, but also that sense of time, the short-term coping that people have to deal with, but the longer term, as Roger was saying, the longer term permanent resettling, or the time it takes to really overcome the events that have happened. Vicky, could you say a bit more about your work, particularly in relation to that question of the sense of place and recovering from shocks, how those shocks are, in Gina's words, mitigated and averted, and how we focus on trust in order to overcome those?
We were faced with a flooding, a flash flood. Many people, it was in the capital city of Port Louis, many people working there, they didn't have any idea where to move on, what to do, whether we have an emergency evacuation plan, procedure. There were no community participation in several aspects of mitigation. And also, many people were trapped in underground parking. They did not know what to do. Some were just trapped in their offices. Many of them didn't know how to communicate. There was a failure in terms of communication channel. And it caused a traumatic situation. Because what happened is that we have known that there were several rivers, canals, which were blocked by unwanted items. There was also several developments, constructions, like a big fast food chain industries, which was built on canals. So it was really a big shock. Most of the early warning system that it's available in Mauritius were not functioning. What I want to study is how to improve that communication system, and also to create a culture of disaster management, so that later on to create that resiliency in people.
That issue of communication, Roger, I'd like to come to you. You talked about three different projects in Colombia, India, and in the Caribbean, the volcanic risk. Does communication differ hugely between those culturally different areas that you've been looking at? Or is there, are there similar issues in good and bad communication in each of those areas?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, acknowledging that that forms of communication obviously vary according to context and the extent to which societies are perhaps more sort of used to command and control type ways of working. But having said that, I think there are principles that are really key. So for communication to be trusted, to be relevant and seen as appropriate to needs, you know, what's absolutely fundamental is that there has to be genuinely two-way and not in some tokenistic way. The authorities and others and NGOs and everyone who may be assisting people to particularly to resettle following a disaster got to be prepared to really listen to the needs of people. And, you know, it sounds kind of obvious, but actually it's not necessarily, because in a lot of situations we found that organizations focusing on recovery, well, they'll focus on particular sectors of need, you know, and perhaps the most obvious ones around housing, around infrastructure, maybe in a kind of, you know, more macroeconomic sense. But of course, you know, fundamental to enabling people to rebuild their lives in another location or where it is to pay attention to a much wider set of livelihood and well-being needs. And, you know, the one that's neglected almost always the most is psychosocial need. And that very much connects with this issue of place, how cultural and emotional connections with place are actually quite often also difficult to disentangle from those perhaps more material connections, where people have gone back to live in zones of high risk, perhaps against official regulations, possibly even against law, which I've seen in a couple of countries I've worked. You have to understand this combination of pull factors, whether you're going to support them in doing that and find ways to mitigate risk of them being there, or make sure that the places that you are supporting them to live in that are outside the risk zones of high risk genuinely do meet all people's human security needs.
It's a huge consideration, right? People feel like they belong somewhere and they want to have that feeling and they want to live in a place that feels like home. And that means that if your family's been there for generations, or even if you've just set things up there, but you feel like it's the right place, this sense of place really pulls people to return to dangerous areas that engineering sciences and management and planning would never, never support establishments and living communities. And yet it is that sense of place that commits people to rebuilding and recovering particular areas. So it is a strength as well as a challenge, this sense of place. And it's something that I really feel that Paola's work helps us understand so deeply as well, and what it means to people in instrumental ways, right? In visual ways, in ways involving sound, in ways involving smells. There are lots of communities that we've seen around the world. In the US, it's very common, for example, to find communities of people that originated in another country and have found a location that makes them feel very comfortable and at home. So fishing communities from Vietnam that now live in fishing heavy areas of the US, and mountainous communities or northern communities from Scandinavia that now live in northern mountainous communities in the US. And these sorts of things are very real. They're drawing people to these areas without really considerations necessarily of what is dangerous or what is stable, physically speaking.
Interesting. Paola, could you say a bit about your work in terms of the recreation of place when the infrastructure, the buildings are no longer in place, and the effect that has on people who survived these shocks?
Yeah, so first of all, I have to say that before thinking about the recreation of place, I'm really focusing now on exploring how people would conceptualize a sense of place, first of all. And this might change based on the communities and the different cultures. So So I went to interview this woman who has created a startup, which is called Mumo. They create scents, perfumes, but starting from culture, like this idea of the cultural experiences. And she told me a story that I thought was really crucial to understand the sense of place and how it can be defined. So before the earthquake, they were creating this startup and they started to do experiments, right? So they wanted to create a perfume which could represent a community, a specific community, the community of Camerino, which is a town, a beautiful town, hit by the earthquake in 2016. It's a town with a university and with a beautiful historic center. So it was a touristic town, and now it's the historic center is a ghost town because it's a red zone and people cannot go there and cannot visit it anymore. So they did this experiment in which they created two scents. One was based on the idea of the historic center. So those smells that might remind, you know, the smell of the bricks and the, you know, the streets of the historic center. And then they created another scent that was based on the natural environment. And they asked the community to rate which one better represented their town and their place. And they voted for the natural one. I think this is poignant. Why? Because in times of displacement, these communities, like their resilience, come from the natural environment. So this is also, you know, when we can explore the edge between tangible and intangible, natural versus cultural heritage, because the resilience of these communities now come from the site and the environment, the natural environment around them. And this is why they don't want to leave. And they're trying to reconnect with this environment, which also hit them so badly because of the earthquake. And they're trying to do that by rethinking tourism in a slow way. And they've created now these cammini, which are trekking trails that cross all the areas which were hit by the last two earthquakes, so that, you know, people will reconnect with those areas through slow walks. And so this is where, you know, the resilience is happening and the sense of place can be described in time of displacement.
That's interesting what you say about that sense of agency, and I'd be interested to hear what the others think about that, the sense of agency, but also I'd be interested to hear about the way that stakeholders you've had to work with, whether that be emergency services, local government, aid agencies, have been willing to explore the less tangible elements of recovery, which are, as we've explored, are significant in enabling resilience. Do you have a thought on that? Gina, can I come to you first?
Certainly. It's very difficult to convince people that it's worth time and money and resources to build resilience to unplanned shocks. That's because you can't plan for the shocks, is what they think. You can, though. You can plan for them. You don't plan them, but you can make plans about how to react to them and how to fortify against them. And when you do that, then the disaster itself, the disruption that those shocks cause, can be much, much less damaging than otherwise. But telling people to use resources now to avert something is very difficult, because once the thing has occurred, then it's much easier to get people interested in spending resources on it. And if you are successful at disaster mitigation, that means that you really don't experience disasters. And so you look at a long list of non-disasters and tell people, this is what we've been striving for. And they say, well, how do we know that that would have happened otherwise? That means that the resources that do exist are targeted largely at engineering type of mitigation and planning, right? They're targeted at building levees and drainage ditches and having supplies of water and food. The early reactions are always relief-based, get people out of harm's way, get people fed and medicated and sheltered. The recovery is not as sexy. It's not as interesting as fueling and helping with the immediate relief. And so when we move to the recovery phase, we see a lot of attention dwindling internationally. We also see in large countries, national and, you know, regional attention to another part of the country dwindling. We see that happening in the US all the time. That means that the idea of a personal resilience is one of the very last things that people want to try to build. Another way to think about it is as an element of culture. And most people don't actively think about their own culture or other cultures and think, oh, let's make that culture of people more resilient. Let's make our culture stronger. Let's use this sense of place to unite people. It's something that is largely an afterthought. And it's the same as building trust. You know, trust is the last thing that people started rebuilding after the civil wars in Rwanda, for example. Everybody wanted the fighting to stop. They built a government. The fact is that the level of trust between the warring factions was so low that everybody believes that it's going to be a precarious recovery until that trust is built between the groups. And it's the same exact thing that we're looking at in terms of the sense of place.
Thanks, Gina. Roger, from your experience, talked about trust, talked about the agency, the people's sense of agency in recovering, but also the involvement of individual stakeholder agencies. Can you tell me a bit about what you found in the research you did in the three different projects you spoke about?
I mean, I think things are changing. You can see changes, at least in the discussions that both governmental and non-governmental agencies are having around issues of vulnerability, issues of resilience, recovery, and agency. So an example I can give is we work with a disaster risk reduction agency in Colombia. As a partner, they've been very positive and supportive about the project, interested, I think genuinely interested in what we're doing and how we go about it. And I think partly related to the work we've been doing, it's helped to provide a stimulus for a new program, which they have, which is, it's called CommunGuerre. Well, that's the acronym, but it's around community-based disaster risk reduction. So we were excited about this. But then we discover that it's a policy that has almost no finance attached to it. So it's putting a principle in place, which maybe that's the first step that's required. But, you know, the institutional inertia really kicks in, of course, when resources come. And if it's a, you know, it's being led by a ministry that tends to have not so much power compared to ministries of finance and so on. So it is difficult, but I do think there are signs of it changing. And I think one really interesting aspect of it is the culture of interaction. In our work, what we tried to emphasize in our interactions with such stakeholders is not to rob people of their agency, to recognize, actually, in many cases, that people have demonstrated extraordinary capacities in resilience, to have a starting point that respects the situation they have, that sees them as deserving of support, but not as kind of sponges soaking up support and not give anything back. Because we also know that the bulk of recovery work is what people do themselves and in their communities. So there's a shift that's required in that dialogue, encouraging people on the ground to understand their rights and to be able to say, yes, we're a citizen of this country, therefore we're entitled to certain assistance. And then that shift with these stakeholder organizations of seeing people less as a sort of a burden on resources.
Vicky, do you, from your experience, feel that the dynamic is shifting, that stakeholder agencies
are recognizing the needs of the people, of them having agency, of listening to them. Is that happening in Mauritius or not?
In fact, here in Mauritius, we have the National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Center. And what they are doing is that they are doing programs in disaster drills, disaster simulation. They are doing programs which are involved along coastal regions. And several simulations are being done whereby the people are involved in those programs. So by involving them and encouraging their participation, they are better equipped in case of flooding. But one thing earlier mentioned by Gina is that it's really difficult to change the mindset of people, change that behavior and create that culture. For example, when there's a flooding, you are shifting people from an unsafe location to a shelter. But what happened is that after the flooding, those people, they return back to their initial area, okay? They has created a sort of belonging to that place, even though they know that in any sort of flooding, it will be disastrous for them and their family. What we want to do is to create that trust for to create that resilience.
Okay, thanks very much, Vicky. That issue of trust, once again, we keep coming back to this. I'd be interested to hear, taking a step back almost, about your experience as academics, as researchers, in dealing with people who are probably quite vulnerable in terms of their current position. Are they accepting of your work? Are they willing to engage with your work? Or do they see you as an outsider imposing at a time that they don't necessarily want outside imposition?
Yeah, it's a really key thing. I mean, I'm very conscious of who I am, which is, you know, a white British academic. And I do go into communities, I do talk to people. But I like to think I work really hard to try to sort of level things out and make it very clear that actually the experts in the room or in the place where we're talking to people are not me. It's the people themselves who face the risk on a day-to-day basis and are managing recovery. My role is to try to understand that, but also increasingly in our work to try to enable people's own voices to come through. It's about giving voice and it's about giving space and it's about trying to level things up. I mean, the other point to make is that I would never work solely in a context that's not my own without partners from that country. So, yes, those barriers are there and you have to work hard sometimes to get people to recognize the value of what you're doing. But I think that's part of the dialogue.
Gina, can I come to you with the same question, really? Does that chime with your experience?
Sure, absolutely. Everything Roger said is absolutely correct. One of the things that I like to do and that I try to do with my work, because I'm so concerned about adaptation and mitigation as well, is to try to lay this sort of groundwork before the critical event happens. And to use that as an introduction and a reason why people would, or a way to build trust with people. So what that means is that, you know, we see that droughts are coming often years in advance. We know that they could lead to famine. We know that every year mudslides happen in the same areas of Nepal and Thailand. We know that hurricanes have really bad years every 4 or 5 years. And we know when to expect El Nino and La Nina to actually make those things happen. So there are lots of things that we can do and go to these communities and make those ties that Roger indicated.
Paola, I wanted to come to you for some final thoughts about what people's responses have been. How have people reacted to your work within the areas affected?
So we still have to launch the documentary. So we still have to see the effects of the final product. But one thing that really struck me while we were interviewing people was that some of them had never talked about their experiences before our interviews. We had a lot of testimonies, people saying, oh, it's the first time I can talk about this, and it is painful, but it's also very useful. It is time to do it. And so it's like maybe they had reflected on the whole process, maybe not. Maybe that was the first time someone had forced them to really think about the whole time. There were a lot of people who, surprisingly also I think for themselves, talked about the time in displacement as a time of deep pain, definitely, but also a lot of nice moments where the community was able to bond together. They said, while in displacement, we were able to recreate a sense of community and excitement for what they could become. When we think about resilience, we should also think about bouncing back better. So it's not just bouncing back, it's bouncing back better. So there are mistakes that communities make or that they experience because of top-down approaches. And bouncing back better means having the time to reflect on those mistakes, to think about the kind of community they want to become in the future. It should be something that the government should embrace.
I think that's such an interesting idea, because I'd not really thought about that sense of almost disaster and displacement being an opportunity, not an opportunity you'd seek, but actually being an opportunity to bounce back better, to work together, to bond together, to be almost a better community than the one that has been destroyed. It seems like an appropriate place to finish our discussion. I'd like to thank all four of our participants for joining me today, Gina, Roger, Paola, and Vicky. Thanks also for all those who made this podcast possible, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin of Purple Planet, who provided the music. This episode and all our previous episodes can be found at the Eastern Arc website at www.easternarc.ac.uk/podcasts. I hope you can join me again next time when we will, once again, explore the further reaches of the Eastern Arc.